This is Telling the Truth. My guest today is named Sarah, and she's from Italy. And the way that she and I got acquainted and have begun to get acquainted is because of some work that she is doing to connect white Christian young people with other white Christian young people, with the idea being that people need a way to find appropriate spouses in this life. And I know that, Sarah, I know that you do some work like that. I also know that you like to sing and you express yourself well in singing. And so that's what I know so far. Thank you for coming on with me today.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So let's get you situated for me geographically for the moment. I know you're in Italy, but where in Italy, and what's your, tell me a little bit about you as an Italian, if you would. Where you live, what, you know, the whole connection you have to your country. It's important to me.
Okay. I am from the north, and Italy is an amazing country. I personally think, maybe I'm a bit biased, but I think it's one of the best countries in Europe, at least. It sets a real example for diversity, because in Italy, everywhere you go, there's something different to see based on the provinces, even that you go to. There's different food, different music, different ancient customs. So I really like it. And it's very, very different even when it comes to language, because before Italian was a thing, we would not be able to really understand each other, especially from north to south. We would speak totally different dialects, and it was a real struggle during the unification of Italy, for example.
And so, okay, update me a little bit, because I don't know Italian history very well. I first want to focus on that language part. So you mentioned that before Italian was a thing. Now, from what I've read, it was about as recent as the 1960s, really, because of television, which had to be watchable all across the country, that Italians began to speak a language which allowed them to understand each other across their nation. So is that right? Is that about, so what we now call Italian, the language that we say that's Italian,
yes,
that language is really a modern language. It exists primarily in that form since about the 1960s. Is that right?
That's right. Absolutely right. The Italian we know today differs a lot even from the Italian that Americans, for example, Italian Americans speak, because it's a mix between Americanisms and a dialectal form of Italian,
yes,
especially from the South, because that's where they come from usually.
Yes.
Italian was not a thing before the 1960s because of the TV, as you said, which is true, but not on an intellectual level. In the 1800s, there was this committee in which intellectuals, Italian intellectuals, got together and they asked themselves, how can we communicate with each other? What is the original dialect? What is the original Italian? Based on which dialect? So they got together and they chose the dialect from Tuscany, from the traditional literature, for example, Dante, Dante's Inferno, Petrarca, which this is where the Petrarch Petrarch's sonnet comes from, for example. They got together and they chose that dialect as the Italian dialect. So as any language, they took the main things, the main aspects of that dialect, and tried to make it modern. And Italian eventually started transforming, first through the literary examples that we have from like Alfieri, which was a writer in the 1800s, and kept changing until we got to the standard Italian that we have today. But of course, it's changing today. Still.
Of course, right. Languages are fluid, so they continue to progress. Now, okay, give me a sense of how the language that you now call Italian, the language that you would say speak to your teachers at school, or that your teacher would speak to you if she's lecturing, how does that language compare to the way, let's say, that Dante wrote?
Okay. I have the Divine Comedy, Divina Commedia, as you would call it in Italian, right here with me.
Okay, great.
Which is very good. So since the Inferno is the most well-known part of the Divine Comedy, I'm going to read the first part, which is when Dante first wakes up in the dark woods of sin. So Dante wrote: nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai in una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. And this is how Dante would write. But of course, even today, even as Italians today, we struggle understanding what Dante was writing, because in Italian it would mainly translate to: giunto a metà del percorso della mia vita terrena, mi ritrovai in un bosco oscuro, poiché la via del bene era smarrita. Which, for a non-Italian speaker, maybe can sound pretty similar, but in my opinion, modern Italian is way less... It's not as beautiful, not as poetical as dialects can be, especially yes. The dialect from Florence. Because if I look at my dialect, it's pretty, it has a lot of Germanic sounds, a lot of maybe French sounds. Yeah. So it's pretty harsh to hear.
Yeah.
A word, for example, an Italian word like prosciutto, for example, in my dialect becomes pursuit.
Oh, wow. That sounds very Germanic, actually.
Yes.
Like you said. Yeah. So how far north is that? Are you close to Milano? Where are you exactly?
Yeah, I mean the region where Milan is, so Lombardy.
Okay. And is that actually was a part of France at one point, yes?
At one point, yes. And all of North Italy, except Veneto, Trentino, that were under the Austrians, were under French influence, especially even during the Wars of Independence that we had during the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. Because even in our struggle against the Austrians, we asked Napoleon III for help.
Yes.
And the whole influence was like very, very heavy in general.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Interesting. And do you know anything about your family's background or roots as far as, excuse me, this region is concerned? How your mother's side of the family, your father's side of the family, do you know what regions of Italy your parents are connected to or grandparents?
Okay. My surname is actually pretty... like the surname that I got from my dad's family, of course, it's very rare to find. So it was pretty easy to find an origin, a common origin from the very beginning. And from what he said, my surname was recorded was in Veneto.
Oh, really?
Which is another reason, yes. Well, from my mom's family, I would say Lombardy, just because the heaviest concentration for that name, for that surname, is in the region I live in today. So from okay,
that's very interesting. Now, Venice happens to be my favorite place in Italy. It's also the only place in Italy that I've ever visited, so I'm a little biased that way. But I do know, from having studied a little bit about Venetian history and culture, that it has quite an ancient history of its own, including its own language, which is not called Italian and never was. In fact, when I was there, I even met a girl from one of the old Venetian families, and she told me, I think, that her boyfriend is still fluent in Venetian completely. Like, it's a complete language, and it doesn't sound, and Italians can't speak with them. It's not mutually intelligible. It's a different language. Yes. So do you have some Venetian blood then, likely?
I don't know about Venetian. I don't know the city in particular. I just know Veneto in general. But our dialect, the dialect that I speak, is actually not that far from the Venetian dialect.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, it's the noble people that mainly speak in dialect.
Interesting.
These days.
Very interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense because it's a refined, sort of an insider way of speaking that most people wouldn't be able to make sense of. Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. And when you vacation inside of Italy, do you have any favorite places to visit for swimming or beaches or anything like that?
Okay. I have two places in particular that I really, really like. One is Costa Amalfitana, which is in Campania. Uh-huh. So near Naples, but they have their own thing. And I love Sicily when I went, so I would really like to go back one day.
Nice. Very nice. Okay, now a little bit of your Sarah story. We've got sort of Sarah's Italian story. Your national yeah. story, your family story a little bit. And I ask for vacation spots because I've never been on a beach in Italy. And I understand you have some great coastlines.
So. Oh, you're missing out then.
Well, as I live in northern Greece, I can tell you we have some spectacular beaches. I have to recommend that you come and
do
a summer vacation here at some point. So now tell me a little bit about you, especially how you became aware of the importance of what it is to be white, the importance of what it is to be European, the importance of what it is to be Italian and Christian, this identity as an Italian, a Christian, as a European, all of that from conversations we've had or from the little that we've spoken so far, all of those things really inform your values and your priorities and what you care about and what you want for yourself in this life. And I'm really curious how you developed that kind of an awareness, which is certainly not a mainstream awareness in, well, at least not where I'm from, or anywhere that I know of. So how did you sort of come awake and alive in that sense towards your race and the importance of how that connects also to your religious identity?
I got introduced to this world very early on. I was 14 when I first first told about the fascist movements that in Italy still exist today, mm-hmm. which do political actions and even presented themselves for the elections. So at 14, I didn't know anything except mm-hmm. the propaganda that I was told in school.
Of course,
which was pretty heavy. Italy is one of those, like, of the worst places when it comes to propaganda. I would say, like, Germany. But unlike Germany, the fascist sense, the fascist spirit in people never wore out. Because throughout Italian history, from the First Republic to now, fascists and never disappeared from the scene, from the political scene. In the 70s, the 1970s here in Italy, we call the Iron Years, where fascists and communists would meet each other in the street, and many people got killed during those years.
Yes.
Especially young students. And so I started going to, with my friends who first introduced me, started going to the headquarters of these fascist movements. I started going to the events.
As a teenager, so you were 14, 15 at this point?
Yes.
Interesting. Yes. Wow, okay.
I started talking with those people, and slowly I started falling in love with these ideas. I started finding, I in some way found myself in these ideas. I like to say that it's in my blood, in a way, because my great-grandpa fought both world wars and died as a fascist, and he was always proud of it.
It is very much in your blood, then. I was going to ask you about any personal connection to Mussolini, and that certainly is one, if your grandfather fought. In both world wars, right? In both.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, very interesting.
I have the medal from the first one, too. Yes. It's somewhere. I need to find it.
that's really something else. That's incredible. Okay, so here's what I'm curious about. I know, at least I have an idea, not an on-the-ground idea, but from my German friends who are nationalists, I know that inside contemporary German culture, it is either totally unacceptable or even illegal to draw direct lines of connection between oneself, one's family, one's politics, and the Third Reich or the Nazis under Hitler. So it seems to me from what you're saying, in Italy, there's more room to even have that conversation.
Yes. Yes. Even in mainstream politics, there have been some politicians who have said Mussolini, at the end of the day, did some good things for Italy.
Totally.
They cannot say he was a great person, of course, but even looking at the Italian constitution, Mussolini could have been elected 4 years after the constitution was first written.
Yes. Yes.
And Italians in general are very proud of their ancestry. And it's always like this great division between people when it comes to that. There's never like, Mussolini did some good things, but also the communists. It's always like Mussolini did some good things or Mussolini did nothing good at all.
Right, right.
Because I think it's because Italians are very tribal people, tribalistic people.
Yes, yes, yes. Indeed. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Mussolini. Okay, so I'll tell you my perspective on Hitler and Mussolini. If I was going to put it in a nutshell, in the simplest possible nutshell, it's oversimplification, but just to start with, I would say, basically, I have warm-hearted feelings toward Mussolini and not so much toward Hitler. That's basically my sense of it. And here's now a very personal view. My view of Hitler is that his real long game, his real vision for himself was to be worshipped as a man on earth, like, say, a pharaoh of Egypt, or like was common in ancient pagan cultures where they might actually believe that their prince was both a god as well as their actual ruler. I think that's what Hitler wanted for himself ultimately. I think, no, he didn't get that going, obviously, but he was moving that direction. And so this led him to, at least this is my view, to basically use the church in Germany, but as a tool simply to advance his power without any genuine sense of good feeling or goodwill towards religion. That's my sense of Hitler. Now, by contrast, my understanding of Mussolini is that he was not a religious man personally, and he admitted that. So he admitted to personally being an atheist, but he also believed, and he really believed this, that religion was good for his people. And so he rewarded those who were married in the church and who had children and who lived in a traditional and religious manner because he knew it was good for his country. So my basic take on Mussolini is he was an atheist, but a strong supporter of religion and a public supporter of religion, whereas Hitler did not really admit to atheism. But it seems to me Hitler was basically a megalomaniac whose ultimate end game. Now, he did want good for Germany. I do believe Hitler wanted the best for Germany, for sure. But I also believe that he really would have been happy if people were bowing down and worshiping him as a man. Whereas Mussolini was not, he was not ever looking for that. He never, ever, ever was looking to be actually bowed down to as a god. That wasn't real for him. But he knew that Italians were better Italians when they were religious, and so he was a huge promoter of religion, also of the classics, also of great art and ancient architecture, a tremendous conserver of ancient culture. Even on the island of Rhodes, which he controlled, it's still way more beautiful than the other Greek islands. Why? Because Mussolini ran it for a while, so it's beautiful still. And all the classical things are perfectly preserved. Not because the Greeks did that, because Mussolini did that. So that's why I basically say I have pretty warm feelings generally towards Mussolini. And by the way, he was also actually hung. There's a reason that if you really look into the details of what happened to Hitler after World War II, no, he didn't commit suicide in a bunker. And the CIA knew he did not. He got away with the other ruling class Nazis, and they built beautiful villages in South America in the mountains. And those villages are still there today. You can go visit. They're there, and they all speak German. So I think there's a reason that Mussolini was killed and Hitler got his backdoor escape. It's because Mussolini was the real danger, because he was a real traditionalist. He was a real supporter of not only tradition with the cultural sensibilities, but of the Christian religion. And that was too much of a threat that the Allied forces said. So he hung. Mussolini died, and Hitler, the megalomaniac, was allowed to, oh, we'll give you a backdoor out. Passage to South America for you and the other high-ranking Nazis, and you can live to a good old age. So that's a little bit of my sensibilities about Hitler and Mussolini. I don't like the nationalist fan base for Hitler really, really very much at all, and I don't know why there isn't one for Mussolini. I think it's because he was so overtly religious in terms of what he promoted. People still have a hard time with that about Mussolini today. That's so. What do you say about all this?
Okay, the fact that Mussolini was an atheist is right, but only up to a certain point, because there is a book that has been written, which unfortunately is only in Italian, but I am planning on translating it in English, which is called The Religious Conversion of Mussolini, in which his conversion during his life, his religious conversion, led him to Christianity again. And I'm a Catholic, so I believe in people like Padre Pio, which was a saint. And when Mussolini's wife went to Padre Pio and asked him, what about Benito? What about my husband? Is he saved? And Padre Pio said to her, yes. Go in peace. Mussolini is in heaven. So I'm a strong believer in Padre Pio. He's one of my is one of the people I look most up to in terms of Christian feeling.
Yes. And that's beautiful the way you say that, my dear Christian. I'll tell you something. Although I'm an Orthodox Christian, I have read his life and some of his counsels, I mean, Padre Pio, and I was profoundly, profoundly touched. It's obvious that he had a tremendously close relationship with God in a way that most people, perhaps even most saints, won't have. I mean, he was very, 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 he was just a tremendously, profoundly spiritual man. And so it really doesn't surprise me at all that he would say that about Mussolini, because the way that I see it, and this may be the wrong way to speak, but this is kind of the way I feel about it. It was as though God allowed Mussolini to give his own life for his country. And that is one of the most God-pleasing possible ways to die. You might notice this picture here.
Yes.
So that is the Romanovs, the holy royal martyrs.
Yes.
They're all saints. Saints Nicholas, Alexandra, Olga, Tatiana, Mary, Anastasia, and Alexei. They were all murdered by the Bolshevik Jews. Yes. At the command of, I forget if it was Trotsky or whomever it was, but basically they're great saints, and I pray to them every day, and I feel that they were very much beloved of God because he allowed them to die for who they were. They were Orthodox monarchs. Every one of them was a threat to the Bolshevik Jewish atheistic socialistic mentality, and so that's why the Bolsheviks slaughtered them. And it was very much the jealous Jews slaughtering Christians. So they're martyrs and beautiful saints of our church. They also had a great many pictures taken of them because they loved photography. So there are an enormous numbers of, just a huge number of photographs of all of the Romanovs. Color, black and white, everything. They were one of the first main ruling families in the world to adopt photography into their lives. So they sat for photographers constantly. They also took pictures all the time. They were themselves photographers as well, which was amazing at that time in history, in the early 1900s. That was a big deal. So they were kind of like the first Instagram family, basically.
Yes. Really, is there a best way to go into our Father's hands, into our Father's arms, and dying for him in his name? I don't think there is, even though it's scary. It's scary.
Of course. You know? Yes, 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 no doubt. But I got to tell you, I'm really touched by having you tell me about your religious faith, because I've met plenty of religious people in my life. I grew up with extremely religious people as a Protestant in the United States, and then I became an Orthodox Christian when I was 25, which is eventually how I ended up in Greece. I lived not only in the city, but in the neighborhood where St. Paul brought the Christian religion to Europe.
Oh, wow.
Literally to my neighborhood. Exactly. The first divine liturgy served in the city was served by St. Paul himself just up the hill from my home, like right, exactly right here.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so it's like the apostolic era. Oh, and the first book in the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians, was the first book written in the chronological order of the New Testament, you know, by time order. And it was a letter written to the Christians of this city. That's how paleo-Christian the life is here. It's like very much so, you know. One of the big basilicas in the city was built after the first ecumenical council, the first one. Ecumenical Council number one, and then they built that right after it. So it's like, this is that kind of a vibe, and I'm here for that reason. But I got to tell you, you're the first Italian that I've met who is a deeply pious, soulful person with strong religious feeling who is willing to talk about it. So that's a special joy, a special blessing for me.
Yeah, it's sad, really, because you go to church, you can only see white heads in front of you.
Oh, it's all people. Old people. Yeah.
You telling youth does not believe in God anymore. They, most of the Christian youth is actually ashamed of admitting they believe in God because they know how much they would be mocked for it.
Wow, is it that bad? I had no idea it was that bad. That's really surprising. That's surprising. Okay, now let's correlate that. Because I get now by talking to you, you really mean it with your religious faith. And so do I. And I don't meet a lot of other people like that. Even in nationalist circles, I don't meet a lot of people like that. A few, like in Greece, for sure, I know that I have one nationalist friend. One, literally one.
Only one.
And I have pretty conservative Greek friends. So I tend to have religious friends. but of those who were conscientiously religious, maybe some of them are nationalists in the way that we mean it. They just don't talk about it. They probably do feel that way, actually. They may not say it. But of those, I only have one who will come out and say it. Like, you know, I'm a nationalist. This is what I believe. And I have others who would probably, if you ask them, they'd say, yeah, for sure. So they, you know what I mean? Like, that actually is part of what's in their heart. But what I'm curious is, from your standpoint, what is it like having clear, nationalistic, pro-white views and also being devout in a Christian sense? How has that been for you? Do you find that puts you in an even smaller category?
Hey, this is
the real conversation.
This is an interesting question.
Yeah.
Because I was one of those young people that stopped believing in God completely.
Okay.
And I reverted only very recently, actually, in 2020. I had a complete meltdown in front of my dad. My dad is one of the most religious people I've ever met in my life. I went to him and I said, "Dad, what did I do? Will I ever be forgiven?" I started crying and I said, I'm never going to heaven now because I've done so many bad things. I've said so many bad things about God. And it just told me, calm down. This is God calling you. So accept his call. Pray the rosary. Of course, Catholics pray the rosary. Yes. And read the gospel. Took me a bit to go to church, to start going to church.
Yes, of course.
And so I was a nationalist, a fascist before I was a Christian. And when I put the two things together, when I actually reverted back to Catholicism, I saw the whole picture. I saw the whole picture because there's no, because fascism is not all, I've understood that fascism is not just a political movement. Fascism is about expressing the natural laws, the laws of God and what God, and I wouldn't say want, because that would be a bit too prideful to assume to know what God really wants, but it just felt like it made so much sense. And it makes you realize that to really be a fascist, you need to be a Christian. Because what does the modern world hate more than people who actually love their people and love God? Yes. The modern world hates it. When you say you're a Christian, the people start yelling at you. You're a bigot. You are this and you are that. Always assuming what you do and what you think, like. Calm down and ask me what I think, and I will tell you gladly.
Yes, yes. That's the spirit of paganism that's alive in them. The spirit of paganism, the spirit of atheism, the spirit of Antichrist. It simply hates Christians. So those demons who are around them and inside of them stir up their hatred immediately. It's not rational. It's not logical. It's not scientific. It's not based upon anything that they know. It's based upon feelings that are inspired by the demons, and the demons, the devil and his demons, they hate Christ and they hate Christians and they hate anybody who uses the name of Jesus. So that makes sense, actually, but only when we look at it in a spiritual way. When we look at it spiritually, that response that they're giving you makes perfect sense. Okay, so you're very blessed to have the father that you have. You're very blessed.
Yeah. Especially to have a father present nowadays.
And who is also such a devout and pious man. I hope to meet your father one day and to shake his hand. That would be an honor for me. I got to tell you, I've talked to lots of people in nationalist movements, and I have some very spiritual and very religious people in my life. I'm trying to think if even one of them has told me anything like that about their fathers, by which I mean their biological fathers. Yes, there are definitely people I know who've been very touched by a spiritual father, like a priest that they became friends with, or a mentor, like within the nationalist circles, who's become like a father figure. But in your case, you're talking about your actual father, your own biological father, who also has inspired you on a social, political, and spiritual level. That's really, that's a rare blessing. God loves you, sweetheart.
Yeah, I'm very blessed God on so many levels.
Okay, now, tell me a little bit about your mom, because there's always two streams that come together, you know, for the third human to emerge. So how does your mother feel about, let's say, both areas, both your religious feeling, your religious sensibility, and your political views, and your views including politics and race and the whole nexus of that? So contrast and compare for me similarities, differences between mom and dad and these conversations as those are for you.
Okay, I actually have a funny story about my mom. When I was 14 and she understood that I started like hanging out with people who were fascists or from fascist movement, nationalist people, I was in my room and she called me and said, "Sara, can you please come to the kitchen?" I was like, "Oh my, what have I done now?" What have I done now?
So it sounded a bit serious the way she presented that.
Yes, yes. She told me, she was in the kitchen at the sitting at the table. She told me, "Sit down." I was like, "Oh, what happened? Is something happening? Something wrong?" She looked at me and she's like, "Are you a right-wing extremist?" So I bursted out laughing. I was like, "Yeah, but what is the problem with that?" And she was like, "No, but do you know those people are violent and yada, yada, yada," whatever they always say. Because a mom, of course, is always your mom, and she's always scared you're going to get yourself in trouble. So at first she opposed it. And unlike my dad, who does not share my beliefs politically, but was always more reserved when it came to these things, it was like, "Okay, I trust you. Do it if you think it's right for you." So when they started actually seeing, like meeting the people I would hang out with, they started convincing themselves that they were not the monsters the media portrayed them as. So they both calmed down, and now they fully accepted, not themselves, unfortunately, haven't been able to convert them politically, but they just, it's not a big deal.
Beautiful. I'm when it came happy to know that.
Yeah.
So go on, when it came to?
Yeah, when it came to religion.
Yes.
Of course, I'm always a bit extreme in my ways. I'm either full in or full out.
Yes.
Could be also because of my age. And
I would say no. I would guess no. You're 18 and I'm 42. I've always been like that, the way that you just described. Like, that's ever since I was anybody can remember. So I don't think it has anything to do with your age. I think it has to do with that's just you. You commit. When you commit fully. That's how you do it.
Yeah. And yeah, she believes in God. She goes to church, but she was always like, "Are you not being too extreme about this? Do you want to become a nun now?" And I was like, "No, Mom. Like, it would be great. It would be great. Imagine just living your life fully devoted to God. Maybe in a monastery, in a convent, not a monastery. Away from everybody." I thought about it, to be honest. But then you look at the world and you say, I think my job is actually to find a good man and have a wife, family.
Yes. Yes. Beautiful. Beautiful. So that's very, very, very interesting. So your mother, in response to your religious conversion, was actually a little concerned, like maybe you're going to become fanatical or something now.
Yes.
Yes. And no grandbabies if that happens.
Okay.
Interesting. So I can infer the personality of your mother a bit. I'm going to guess. I think your mother she's affectionate and caring, and she's a gentle person, and she just wants what's best for you.
Actually, I wouldn't say that my mom is a gentle person, because she works as an accountant, so she has to deal with bankers a lot, and that made her very aggressive during the years.
So she can be aggressive if necessary.
Yes.
But I would guess it's more of a learned behavior. It's not a
It's
not a deep disposition. Yeah. So she seems to want whatever you believe is good for your happiness. And if that includes nationalism, that includes fascism, and even if that includes religion in a strong and pious way, then as long as she gets that, like, you're okay, that's my sense. She's kind of looking at you, like, is my daughter okay? And she's looking at you pretty honestly, like a mother can. She's saying, yes, actually, it looks like my daughter's okay. She seems happy. So, and at the end of the day, she just wants her daughter to be happy. She just loves you.
Yes. I'm very lucky. When it came to family, I think I actually understood the meaning of love because of my parents. And it was not an ordinary thing, because my dad had a stroke when I was 12 years old. Mm. It was in summer, and it was very hard. It was like very hard on us. My mom was constantly, well, it was never at home. She was always at the hospital and then working. And my dad then went to a rehabilitation center, and was hanging out with, like, he made some friends there. And the stories that would come out from that place were, like, sad, because you have no idea how many men have been left because they became disabled. But my mom has always been overly protective in some ways, but it's almost as if she fell in love again with my dad after my dad became a disabled man.
Wow.
So
you have a beautiful mother and father. With respect to their character.
I'm blessed.
Yes, you are, darling. Now, are you one, or do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a brother, an older brother.
How old is your brother?
He is 25.
Oh, because he's a bit older than you then. Like 7 years, 18, 25 is actually
pretty
good. Yeah,
6 years older.
And have you had conversations with him about religion, about politics, about race?
Like brothers and sister, we would not talk much. It was more a bunch of quarreling. And I actually never sat down with my brother to have a deep conversation about politics or God. It was more related to personal problems.
Yes. Got it. And does he live near you? Is he still in northern Italy, or is he...
Yes, lives near me.
Well, I invite you, if you feel so inspired, if you feel like you have an opening, I invite you to have coffee with your brother sometime, or whatever you drink with your brother, and say, hey, we've never talked about religion, we've never really talked about politics, we've never really talked much about race. Let's talk about these things. I want to share my experience. Could you do that with your brother?
I think I could.
That's amazing.
I'll try at least.
Because I promise you that there are people, I'll tell you, I know other nationalists your age in Europe, and different, not in Italy, but in other European countries. And I was telling this to an older nationalist friend of mine the other day. I am most impressed with the nationalist women that I have met who are your age, by far. I find the most traditional views, the best understanding. And also feminism and the culture has had less of a chance to wreck you. But most of the people who are in countries other than Italy seem to live in a place where they might have very strong and clear nationalist views, complete with a view of history and religion, like a really thorough, deep view, and they can't breathe a word of it even to their own parents. because of their culture. And that really makes me feel deeply for these nationalist young people. I mean, late teens, early 20s, like 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Because I talk with these people online, sometimes face-to-face, voice-to-voice, whatever. And they have really done their homework. Like, they understand politics. They understand history. They understand the philosophy of things and even the science. They like really have done their homework. And I'm just shocked to hear that in Europe today, not Italy, but in other places like Germany, like the Netherlands, as examples. I don't know so much about France. I think France has more room for religion as well in certain circles. Mm-hmm. But especially these more progressive, Germanic parts of yours. If you could have these kinds of views, then you can't even talk to your parents. That's pretty harsh to have to live in that sort of a psychology, you know? Especially once you want to talk about race. Race is like, even the religion thing, I think in a lot of the secular Europe, it's like, oh, whatever, my kid, you know, I met a Belgian boy, Belgium, who became an Orthodox Christian. Strict, like really conservative, baptized in a Serbian Orthodox church. And Belgium is more or less an atheistic nation.
Right? Yes. So,
and he by himself converted, very, very, very pious. And his parents were kind of like, okay, it's cool. Whatever. All right. But I can imagine if instead of having that happen, he had to sit his parents down and say, Mom and Dad, I've realized that I must marry a white European girl, and that's really important to me. That might have made his parents more alarmed.
Yes.
You know? So.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
How do we. So now I think you can speak to this. So how do we connect with each other as single people, as white people of European heritage who are also Christians? How do we connect with, that's why I said, if you can talk to your brother about these things openly, then gosh darn it, do it.
Okay.
I can have maybe 50% of this conversation that I'm having with you with my brother. The other half, you know which half, we can't have that conversation, you know.
Mm-hmm. And
that was true with my mother until very recently. Now she'll listen to me on the racial stuff, but still with my father, it would be like, you know, like I've grown three heads or something. It's just very, very taboo. Yeah. Even amongst Americans who would be considered the most conservative people, they don't really know what conservatism is anymore, to be perfectly frank. They just don't. They've lost the story of conservatism. And so how do we connect with each other? How do we facilitate relationships like this amongst those of us who can speak freely, who can share our love of God, our religious approach to life, and also our commitment to, if we're going to marry within our race?
Yes. Well, that is one of the reasons why me and a friend of mine actually created White Christian Dating on Telegram. Because the internet is a curse, but also a blessing, because it helps us connect with people with our interests without having to bend down to meeting people who share maybe half, maybe just a bit, maybe nothing at all, because we have no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
And through building these communities, it creates a sense of belonging that men need, that men crave, especially young people. This is why also mixed race kids struggle so much with mental issues, because they feel like they do not fit anywhere.
Yes, and they've had that experience ever since they were born. They just know it.
Exactly.
They just know it. Yeah, and it's psychologically problematic. The psychological literature is very clear about that. It's not politically correct to say it. It's just the truth.
Saying the truth is not politically correct anymore.
Generally speaking, it's not. That's correct.
Yeah. So me and this friend of mine, we were like, I was telling her, because she is the matchmaker, really. So you've helped me meet the person that I'm pretty certain I will marry one day. And you've made me very happy, and I'm not the first person you've made. You've made this happy. So why don't we make a platform for people to meet based on common interests, based on common common values, like the pride in being white and the pride in being Christian. That's where, and we created the channel White Christian Dating, and of course you have to be white, you have to be traditional, and you have to be Christian. Even though I must admit a lot of blacks have reached out to us, which I thought was very odd, because it literally says you have to be white.
Right.
Requirements.
Yeah.
And we've made quite a bit of matches so far, and people have been reaching out to us saying, wow, we're really happy, thank you, I'm really getting along with this person. The only problem is it's hard to find someone from your own country that shares the same values as you.
I've noticed that.
So, yeah, we always ask them, are you okay? We always ask the people that reach out to us if they are okay with long distance. And a lot of them are actually okay, because they've got to the point where they're like, there's nothing good near me.
Yes.
Some people have suggested, just some people have told us, just tell them to find a girl in church. Okay. We could tell them that. But are you sure they're gonna share the same values as you just because they go to your same church? No.
Yes. So here's an interesting story for you. I won't say your name, but I have a friend here in Greece who comes from a family that is very pious. It's a religious family. So these are people that go to church a lot. I don't just mean Sundays. I mean, they keep all the feasts. They also will keep the fasts. Orthodox Christians have fasting days every Wednesday and Friday, and then 40 days before Easter, 40 days before Christmas. It's a lot. They're serious. Like they're a really religious family. But here's the contrast. Their daughter, who's a friend of mine, because she took voice lessons from me, she's beautiful. She's very intelligent. She speaks Italian, by the way, among other languages. She's very educated, very refined, very ladylike, very graceful. So I was naturally curious to know a little bit more about her. And she tells me that she's going to school to be a dentist. And I was not interested. I was like, oh. So, and I think she failed out of dental school, so she's going maybe to be a pharmacist now or something. But basically, here's what she's not doing. She's not approaching life practically, economically, and socially from a traditional religious standpoint. She is doing what men used to do exclusively 100 years ago, which is become very educated, become a medical professional, create a big practice, and all that. So she has, on the strictly religious sense, you would imagine if you talk to her, she's also very knowledgeable about religion. I mean, she's a serious Christian person. But if you talk to her on the level of politics, on the level of culture, on the leverage of, like I said, economic life, practical life, then the story looks like the feminist version.
Oh.
And that's just what it is. And I realized this girl dresses traditionally. She dresses beautifully. She would never say she's a feminist, but look at what she's doing, the steps she's taking in life, how she's moving through the world. She plans to be the one with the high income. Well, guess what? If you're a dentist or a pharmacist or a doctor, it doesn't also necessarily go along very well with wife and mother, which are full-time occupations. So all of a sudden, as soon as we get into practical life, the traditionalism is out the window. We left that one inside the church. You know, we keep the fasts. We do all of the churchy things, I mean, really well and mean it. But when it comes to, like, how we're going to get married, how we're going to earn our living, how and all of a sudden it looks like a secular feminist approach to life. And I found the same thing in America as well, especially in the like more educated religious circles. Very, very same thing. So it's like they don't realize it, but they're still half feminists, or actually more than that, because what Jesus said is where your treasure is, like where your money is, that's where your heart's going to be also.
Yes.
And so if a woman's doing that with her career and her education, then she's telling you by her actions, she's basically saying, I'm not a traditional woman. You can't count on me to be a traditional Christian female partner because I have lost that story, that song, that whole feeling. It doesn't exist in me, not for practical life. That's only when I'm in church. That's only when I'm taking Holy Communion. That's only when I'm going to confession and when I'm doing good deeds to the poor. But how I behave economically with my money, with my daily living, that can be the feminist strip. And I'm fine with that. And that doesn't work for me. Now, I'm like, have a nice life. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
If we never talk again, that'll be totally fine. So this is really interesting that you and your friend both have a traditionalist view of being. What's your friend's name?
She likes to remain as anonymous as possible on the internet. So I'm sorry, I cannot share her name.
Okay, that's all right. So you and your friend, she's not in Italy, right? She's in a different country?
Not right now, but she lives in Italy.
Oh, she does? Okay.
Yes.
So you're both Italians then?
Yes, we're both Italians.
Okay, got it. All right. But you've had contact with people in other countries around this?
Yes.
And you're, and how is that, how's that effort going generally to connect people?
Those are things we do not touch upon personally with white Christian dating, because in when we mean like have traditional values, we mean also devoting yourself to be a mother and a wife. So we don't really interact with people. We just make them meet each other.
Yes, yes, yes.
We just help them with tips so they figure themselves out.
Yes. But meeting people, so, I mean, that seems to be going well. You are connecting people. You've had people get in touch, yes, and say, we're very happy. That's,
yes,
that's amazing. That's remarkable.
Yeah, so I don't know too much from that perspective, but I totally understand what you're saying. And it's a problem. It's the modern world problem where women still want to be like men.
Yes.
Where women are told you got to be a man, like a man, because if not, you're going to be oppressed. And I'm sorry, is staying home with your kids really that oppressing for you? Exactly. Do you feel like you're dying inside?
Right, right. And here's the point where people give that up. And this would unfortunately include my mother and my sisters. Here's where they give it up. Money. So my mother stayed home and raised us, which is amazing. And I'm very grateful for that. But what did she teach my sisters? The story was about, in case you have to take care of yourself, in case you have no...
Yes.
So what basically happened is, Plan B turns into Plan A, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
If you live like, I'm going to have to be an economic actor just like a man, then that's the kind of life path that they attract. That's the kind of consciousness and a partner they attract, at least on some level. And so, as far as I know, none of my sisters are stay-at-home mothers. They may stay at home part-time sometimes, but none of them. And I have five sisters, and I want to say four of them are married. One is not. So she's, you know, doing the whole single, making money. She makes good money thing. But of the ones that are married, even they are not, they're not living in what I would call a traditional way. Even though they have some religious values that are quite traditional, if you ask them about their religious views, and they have married within their race, so that's there, you know, unconsciously. Yes. But the traditionalism, the sense of what that means, you know, in daily life, between, and then male and female dynamics, you know what I mean? Like the way that a woman's supposed to be with them, all that. like, that's really not there. That's definitely a lot of feminism in that closet. And it becomes uglier and more untoward, and it creates more and more unhappiness as they get older. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah. 40-year-old women writing articles like, I'm 40 years old and I'm single. Why am I depressed?
Yes.
I don't have, wow, maybe because you don't have kids. Yes. I'm still in school because in Italy we have 5 years of high school, unlike other European countries. And I'm talking from a student perspective. Since, if we look at society, we when we're young, people, when they're young, they spend most of their day, most of their time in school.
Yes.
Where definitely. They end up taking in a lot from their teachers. And what I've noticed is basically only two of my teachers are married and have kids.
Mm.
Only two of them. Mm. And all the others are either no kids,
yeah,
or they are not married.
Yeah.
And what's that going to teach kids? And you look at them, they're so frustrated.
Of course.
And they don't understand why, because they devoted their life to studying to become someone.
Yes.
That they forgot everything else. They forgot about them, what their body's asking for.
Yes.
And what what God asked us through our bodies, because we have certain needs.
Yes.
It's because God wills it.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and it's I understand that sometimes, especially in poorer countries, there is a need for a woman to work to, yes, provide, to,
sure,
help the husband,
yes,
pay the rent.
Yes.
Because no government, at least the ones I know of, really help you when you have a kid, when you want to have a family.
Yes.
Especially in Italy. Do you know how high the taxes are here?
I've heard. I don't know. I have no idea what you really pay.
Around 60%.
Yeah, that's absurd. That is absurd.
That's absurd. And the average kid per couple is one.
Mm-hmm.
There are immigrants keep coming in and they have a lot of kids.
Yes.
The Italian population is dying out.
That's crazy.
But all women care for is, and I'm talking because I talk with a lot of young people from my school, from outside of my school.
Yes.
All the girls want is, I want to be rich. I know I'm going to be the rich aunt one day, mm-hmm, who's single and drinks wine and has a lot of cats.
Mm.
That's their goal in life.
So sad, man. That's so sad, because then they have no motive to, well, for one thing, they don't have a strong motive to think carefully about the quality of the men that they date, because they're not planning on settling down with one. On the other hand, if a woman is thinking traditionally, which means she wants to find one man who's right for her and she wants to settle down, then she has to be very careful about the men that she dates, because she's filtering them for, do I wish to be with this man for the rest of my life? And when that's the filtering question, it's much more serious than, do I want to be with this man tonight? Which is a much, you know, it's here today, gone tomorrow, whatever. It doesn't require much seriousness or thinking or deep feeling on behalf of a young woman, if she does not really care about her future in the traditional way, that you can just kind of do whatever. And those women generally become, like you said, very unhappy. Very, very, very unhappy.
Yeah. And it shows even the women that choose to have kids. Let's just look at the youth of today. Kids today lack attention the most.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they've never received attention from their family. Would you really have a stranger take care of your kids? a lot of kids actually end up getting killed. There's in the news everywhere getting killed, beaten up by the same people that should be taking care of your kid, of your kid. Mm. Well, you should be the one ultimately taking care of him, of your son, of your daughter.
Of course.
And you see this lack of attention because the dad is always working, the mom is always working. You got to take care of yourself, or the ones that are lucky enough to have grandparents take care of them, but they're old.
Yes.
They can give you really great life lessons, but at the end of the day, they are your grandparents and not your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why everyone just wants to be internet famous these days.
Ah, that's such shallow nonsense, isn't it? Oh, it's so tragic.
Yeah.
So tragic. So tragic.
So many girls with, as they call them today, daddy issues, because they didn't have a father present. So they always start dating toxic men who will end up hurting them.
Yes. Yes.
Men who date women that end up always treating them badly.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I did some of that. Let me tell you, I definitely did some of that. Ooh, learned my lesson with that one. Yes, indeed. You speak well to these matters. I can tell this is something that moves you deeply as you think about these concerns. Really, really moves you deeply. So tell me, where do you think this is going? I mean, sort of as a movement of white Christian young people becoming conscious about their religion, becoming conscious about their politics, becoming conscious about their race, and about the need to live traditionally in the way that maybe our great-grandparents or great-great-great-grandparents might have considered normal. How do you see this unfolding? And because you talk to people outside of Italy as well, how do you see this unfolding not only in your own country amongst other young people like you, but in other parts of Europe or in other parts of maybe the English-speaking world? How's this going?
There have been a lot of people who actually have turned to Christianity or nationalism during COVID.
That's interesting.
During 2020.
That's very interesting. Very interesting.
I, for one, had a spiritual crisis during 2020.
Yeah.
During COVID times. And I've seen nationalist movements growing more and more every day. More and more young people are joining. They feel like they have to do something.
It's very good. Very good news.
Especially, I see a lot of Americans, a lot of American youth turning to nationalism and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
More so than Europe. Because I've seen that when you see the worst you could ever see, and I think that can be seen in America.
I would agree.
In this, you either fall for it or you become the other face.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
You either go black or you either go white.
Well said. Well said. And are there opportunities from your standpoint to discuss ideas around religion, around politics, around race, where young people are engaging with each other and creating content? And I know that from at least what I've been able to learn about the European nationalist scene, I know that Europe does not have the traditional regard for freedom of speech that the United States does. So in America, if people want to get together and openly, publicly organize in a way that's traditionally religious, that is racially religious, and that is to say just traditional, generally speaking, the government may threaten them and it may take action against them, but they really, the government has its hands tied. with respect to speech concerns, basically. So you can stand up on a box somewhere and say whatever you want about, at least that's what the Constitution protects. Whereas in Europe and in Australia, England, these countries all have hate speech laws where freedom of speech is not a thing. In England, it was never a thing, ever. That's why we made America, because they didn't have that. So yes. How does this go in Europe when you have conversations that you want to have? How do we facilitate this dialogue in such a way that the right ideas can spread and that the right people, maybe even more importantly, that the right people will be able to meet each other, but also so as to protect ourselves from falling afoul of hate speech laws, specifically in Europe? Because I live in Europe now and I like it here. Plan on staying.
This is a trick question. Because, well, in the States, if you're a young person speaking out, they're going to find where you go to school to. They're going to call the principal, say, hey, that person says mm-hmm. this, 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 and that. And you're going to face a lot of consequences. In Europe, it's like this too. But the government can get involved very easily in our lives. Yes. Whereas Americans are very proud of the fact that the government, the small government, that cannot interfere too much. Well, I had to deal a lot, not personally, but while being in a movement with the police, that's a special sect of the police for political extremists.
Yes.
That is always controlling you when you are having a when you're doing a political action, when you're getting together in large groups. They can monitor your chats if they want.
Wow.
And it's not that good. But in Italy, at least, we are very separate from Antifas and fascists. Go two different ways. They hang out in different places, and yes. Both have their own place.
Yes.
In Europe, it's not, from what I saw, I could be wrong, but there's not a way to really get together in real life without having to deal with like special police forces and all of that.
Yeah. Germany might be the worst for these reasons. I think it is the worst in these ways, because I know there the law is very specific about the contents of speech. And there are certain things that you can just say, and that's enough that they will lock you up. And that's legal, completely legal under German law. So I think they have some of the worst policies. And with them, it's around speech. You don't even have to do anything. You don't have to threaten any violence at all. You can just have certain ideas. For example, in Germany, if you wish to tell the historical truth about that event, which is always called the Holocaust, but doesn't deserve that title. If you want to tell the truth about that, and you do so in any public sense, prison, period. That's for sure. And of course, that's pretty disturbing, because we're just having a conversation about history. Literally can't tell the truth about history. That reminds me of the Soviet Union. That's what that reminds me of. So we definitely need strategies and solutions around people. But when you're connecting people along traditional lines, traditional ideas of man and woman, religion and race, then it seems like people can start hanging out one-on-one, travel around Europe, make friends. Have you the feeling that there's a movement building, I mean, inside of Europe now, of young people with strong traditional right-wing views?
Yeah, many movements are rising up. I do not remember the names now exactly, but I've seen a lot of young people getting involved with politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their way of getting together.
Yes.
That's their way of, we are strong because we are together. I'm not the only person thinking like this.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many others like me. Therefore, I'm not scared of speaking out. But I think that, yeah, the internet still gives us it's an amazing platform to get together, spread their own ideas. If you find the right communities, because there's a lot of just bad ones.
That's true. That's true. There are a lot of weird, dark places on the internet. And okay, so let's talk about one tendency in that neighborhood, weird, dark places on the internet. I have found some nationalistic, racially aware circles that are openly anti-religious. I mean, I'll take that back. They're not anti-religious. They're anti-Christian, specifically.
Yeah. 09A, those kind of people, I think.
Which kind of people? Say it again.
09A.
Oh, I don't know who those... Is that a nationalist group?
They say they are national socialists that are openly Satanists.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yes, yes, yes. So I've ran into some people who, in some ways, I really like. People that have views on race that I believe are correct, absolutely correct, and who really understand the science and the history behind that. That I've been very, very happy about. But then when some of those same people are overtly anti-Christian, I find it very, very alarming. And I wonder what you've run into in this neighborhood of racial awareness and religion specifically.
I've seen both spectrums. I've seen, both aspects of, I've talked with people from that are pagans, quote unquote, because we both know that the pagans at the end of the day are Satanists. They worship Satan. And I've talked with Christian people, and it's hard to have a conversation with pagans, because one thing I've seen lately that the pagans thought was very smart was spamming homosexual, like videos of homosexuals on Christian chats. Like, that's going to solve anything. And that's going to prove them wrong because they worship Jews. That's what they always say.
It's just absurd. You're right. That's what they always say. Yeah. They're absurd. They're just absurd. The thing that's most disturbing for me about that is that it's regressive. Our ancestors became Christians because they saw the truth. So to go backwards to paganism, it's to regress. It's to go backwards culturally. It is not the way forward. It is a trap. And if they only knew what they were really doing, I could explain the history of that, but basically in a nutshell, the Old Testament people of God, the Hebrews in the Old Testament, they were white. We have pictures drawn of them right next to pictures of ancient Greeks. They're white people talking to other white people. What happened was, in the Old Testament, around the people of God, around the Hebrews, there were different pagan tribes. And those were the Canaanites, aka black people, not white people. And what some of the people of God did in the Old Testament was they began to intermarry with the Canaanites, and they also began to borrow their customs. So now they're intermarrying with dark-skinned people, and they're borrowing their pagan religious customs. That started another form of religion hidden inside of the real one. And it now is called Judaism. That's what it's called today. And Christ talks about them in the book of Revelation. The Jews who say they are Jews and are not Jews.
Yes, but they are the synagogue of Satan.
That's exactly right, the synagogue of Satan. So what our white family members don't realize who are going back to paganism is they're going to the evil that they hate. The thing that made this Jewish tribal disgusting abomination, which still exists today, which incited the death of our Lord, and which infiltrated as Freemasonry and all these things, promoting homosexuality amongst the clergy, all these things, you know, about. What they don't realize is they are going back to the thing that they say they hate, which is this Zionism, which is just paganism, which is just, like you said, it's devil worship. They don't realize they're just going right back to it. And they're losing themselves.
They are, because one thing always leads to another.
Yes.
Like paganism leads you into esotericism, then leads you into, I mean, at the end of the day, you end up worshipping what they say. Oh, no, I worship Lucifer. I worship Zeus. Yes. I worship Wotan. Well, I hate to break it to you. What? Who were Zeus and the pagan gods, fallen angels?
That's
that
right.
Fell when they sided with Lucifer.
Exactly. Yep. And so they don't realize they're playing right into the hands of the enemy. And they think that the fact that they want to marry within their race is going to help them, when in fact, all they're doing is, with those views, they're corrupting our race. And what happened to the Semites, who were light-skinned people like we are now, is they were corrupted by borrowing the views of the Canaanites, the black people. And so that's the reason that today the Semitic peoples of the earth are no longer light-skinned people who are obedient to the will of God. And there's an Old Testament prophecy about that. It says Japheth, that's us, we're the Japhethites, the descendants of Japheth, will come into the house of Shem. Shem is the Old Testament people of God who gave that position up by embracing pagan worship and intermarriage with the Canaanites. And we, as represented by the Europeans, first the Greeks, right here in the city where I live, mm-hmm. We came into their house. And so St. Paul says, the apostle came to this city where I live, even the neighborhood I live in, it's called St. Paul's, right up above me. He said that the church is Israel now. In other words, we're now the real people of God. It's us. It is the white people, the Europeans, the Christians who have received this. And so marrying within our race, what it means is preserving our genetics and the religious consciousness, which is what makes our genetics possible. That's what it means to marry within one's race. And so this is my, sometimes it feels like hopeless message to my pagan white people friends, like, goodness gracious. Pagans have a bad attitude towards Christians. They just do, and they always have. If you read the history of pagan-Christian conflict, the pagans have had a really bad attitude towards Christians. They just do. And I see that same spirit in them today. So how would you say it looks inside the nationalist frame with respect to religious consciousness amongst the racially aware? What does it look like to you? Like religious people, openly Christian religious people, non-religious people, and then people who are trying to be atheists or pagans or some other. How does the mix look to you right now?
I just think it's Jewish propaganda. Like,
of course,
it's like a useless war between whites, because
yes.
Okay, let's make an example. Let's take Nero. Nero was one of the people of the Roman emperors who most fiercely opposed Christians.
Yes.
You read about him, and what religion did he follow? He was a convert to Judaism. This is what most people don't know. All the people who opposed Christians were actually Jewish or had Jewish connections. And what this is doing, it's people who should be together, fighting together, to achieve one goal, finding that do not want to settle down their differences for a minute, like put down your weapons and look at society. Are you really going to tell me that you're going to bicker about if Christ was a Jew or not, more than looking at at the fact that white people are dying out?
Yes.
Because let's look at Christianity. It's what held Europe together.
It's the only thing that ever did, ever.
Yes.
Europe was just a bunch of different tribes genociding each other by turns until Christianity. That's a fact. There was nothing like Europe, as we now know of, like a Europe with a European culture. That didn't exist before Christianity.
Exactly.
Tribes painting each other blue and stabbing each other. And here's an interesting fact. I have a lot of Welsh blood from Wales. And the Welsh, of course, were pagan. They didn't become Christians until, I think, the 5th or 6th century. And they considered themselves Romans. As soon as they were Christians, they were Romans, and they prayed for the Roman emperor, who was in, by the way, Constantinople. That was their consciousness when they converted. So when the Welsh converted to Christianity was when they stopped having their women and children fight wars. Because when Welsh people were pagans, the men and the women and the children all fought, everybody. It means you had basically families going around slaughtering other families, including your kids who were armed, just like you and your wife, everybody. Did you want to go back to that? You just have like groups of big families going and slaughtering other big families, including your kids, like your 7-year-old slicing another 7-year-old's throat. Okay, if you want that, then just go ahead and revert to paganism. But the organized, orderly, beautiful, covered with architectural masterpieces, with classical art, with the greatest music on earth, all of these things that Europe has, that's Christian Europe. Only and exclusively Christian Europe. Period. That isn't a thing. It doesn't exist. It's not there apart from Christianity. That's the reality. That's the truth. It's the reason why our culture, for better or for worse now, dominates the earth. Minority, right? Numbers, white people are the minority on the earth. But our cultural dominance is without question. I mean, think about 1 billion Chinese people. Are white people wearing Chinese clothing or are Chinese people wearing white people's clothing? It's pretty clear. More than 1 billion Chinese people, and they're wearing our clothing. You can go to Shanghai and you can find a piano teacher that will be able to teach you how to play Mozart brilliantly. Well, can you go to Vienna in Austria and be sure to find a master of ancient Chinese music? No. Why is white people culture dominant? It's because of who we are. And we are who we are as white Europeans because of Christianity. Period. That's it. That's why we dominate the earth for now, for better or for worse. That's why our culture is the dominant one. Everybody knows it, right? Like the Japanese have steakhouses and baseball. And they've adopted them because that's how much they find by way of goodness in white culture. It's just that's what's happened. And that dominant position that we have as white people is ours because we were the ones, or whose ancestors in certain cases, embraced Christianity. And that's who we are. It's what made us who we are. And without that, we're not going to be able to reclaim what is ours. And we're not going to be able to reclaim what is ours culturally either, without a consciousness of what made us this. Who made us this? Well, it's Christ. Christ in us, Christ with us.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And everybody tends to look at the Middle Ages as this terrible period where nothing was invented, everything was still, everybody lived a terrible life. Do they know where this definition comes from? The Enlightenment age.
That's right. And that's Freemasonry. The Enlightenment is the dogma of Freemasonry, which is just Judaism for people that don't think of themselves as Jews. That's all it
is. Exactly. They were the ones who categorized the Middle Ages as something as terrible as everybody thinks of it as today. But in reality, like, a lot of people wear glasses. I wear glasses. I'm wearing glasses right now. When were they invented? Middle Ages. Books, music, culture.
Some of the greatest architecture of all time.
Yes, we have beautiful churches from the early Middle Ages. They're still standing today. We have so much that has been left. That has been left from us, from the Middle Ages.
Yes, yes.
And the Middle Ages actually started getting reevaluated through Romanticism, where the national spirit was rising once again in Europe. We remember people like Fichte and his speeches for the German nation. We see it through so many Europeans fighting because they wanted their land. Because they wanted to claim a culture as their own, as their very own. Because they were proud of who they were. That's when they started reevaluating the Middle Ages. And it was like one of the greatest periods, especially for Italy. We had an incredible political system, an incredible, like that's when all the diversity started, all the white diversity, because these days we have to like really differentiate it, when the beautiful, the culture that we have now started developing. And that was one of the greatest period. That was one of the greatest period for Christianity. Like, can you really go to a European country and not go visit a church?
Yes, exactly.
Like, you're gonna find masterpieces there.
Yes, yes, indeed. By the way, if you do come and visit my neighborhood sometime, one of the things I'll take you to see, speaking of masterpieces, it's about 500 meters up the hill from my house. It's really, really close. It is a small church that was built in the 5th century, like middle 400s. And it has a beautiful mosaic behind the altar. So that mosaic is more than 1,500 years old. And it's perfect. It's in perfect condition. The colors are bright, vivid, psychedelic colors. And they're 1,500 years old. It's of Christ without a beard. There are only three of those in the whole world, by the way, icons of Christ without a beard. And two of the prophets from the Old Testament. And I think a scene from the book of Revelation or something like that. It's extraordinary. People come from all over the world just to sit and look at it. And you can't believe the colors are that vivid. They're psychedelic, bright, vivid colors. And it's 1,500 years old. It's a mosaic. It's not paint, which means it's little pieces of stone gleaming at your eyes. It's just exquisite. And there's a basilica about a 15-minute walk from my house that's about 1,000 years old, still used for services every Sunday, by the way. And it's one of the most architecturally perfect churches in the history of the world. It's absolutely magnificent, like it's a prototype of the ideal church architecture. My neighborhood, the church next to my house, is from the 14th century. The one five blocks over is 1,000 years old. And these are all churches that are still in use. This is alive. And they're also, obviously, they're architectural masterpieces. They're just magnificent gems of human genius. And this is our heritage as white people. This is our heritage as Christians. And as traditionalists, I think this love for art is so critical. It's one of the reasons I feel so blessed to live where I do now. And it's one of the reasons that I felt like I was starving aesthetically, emotionally, and culturally where I was when I was growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then in America generally, compared to where I am now, I just felt like I was culturally starving. And here there's so much more beauty, and the walls of the Roman Empire, 10 minutes that way. We can walk 12 minutes that way and literally stand on the podium where Aristotle taught, like the same stone. You put your foot right on it.
Wow.
There he was, right there, literally. Like, I walk past that like most days. That's my neighborhood. In a city that was organized under the same name, the name of this city, the city was founded and named 2,300 years ago. It's had the same name for 2,300 years.
Wow.
Thessaloniki, or Thessalonica, was the name of Alexander the Great's sister. It's his little sister's name. So the city's like, because her big brother was that, so this is, it got its name, and it's had this culturally iconic status from the ancient world to the modern in an uninterrupted sense for 2,300 years without interruption. My neighborhood has had substantially the same layout for more than 2,000 years. So to be in touch with those kinds of realities, it really does, it warms my heart to be in Europe, to be in this paleo-Christian and still Christian consciousness. And I think the piece that it took me the longest to realize was the racial piece, the racial awareness. That was the one that took the longest to get through to me. So before we finish here today, would you give me a little bit of a sense of how did you become racially aware?
Okay. It was a, let's say, gradual process. Because it started out with the love for my nation. And then slowly came to the love for my people.
Yes.
Because you start seeing how the world pretty much hates you for being white.
Yes.
The propaganda everywhere always includes a black man and a white woman.
Always.
Mixed kids.
Yes.
And you ask yourself, and you're like, why? What is happening? Why do they do that?
Here's a weird fact about the white man. I'm sorry, about the black man, white woman couple, as a little aside. Forgive me for the interruption. It so happens that statistically, that is the rarest kind of couple on earth, literally on earth. But that's the one most promoted by the media.
Yes.
So it's antagonistic to even current reality. Okay, so you started with the love of the nation and then the love of your people that followed.
That's how, yes, it happened.
And how did, yes, this grow in you to the point where you became conscious, oh, marry within my race, promote the marriage of white Christians to other white Christians? How did that racial part, which I consider so important, how did that begin to be fully awakened in you?
Yeah, seeing how much the mixing of races was portrayed, was being put out. Yes. The more I started noticing, the more I started being disgusted by it.
Yes.
Because I said, this is too much. They're like literally bombarding me 24/7 with, yes, you should have thick kids, you should not marry within your race.
Yes.
That I looked at it and I said, this is what they want. This is what they want, and I'm not gonna give them that.
Yes.
I want to preserve the beauty of the white diversity that we have in Europe. Everywhere you go, you can just look at a white person in Europe and you say, yeah, this person is probably from Spain. This person is probably from Poland. This person is probably from England.
Yes.
And yeah, they have all these different characteristics. They blonde with blue eyes, blonde with green eyes, blonde with brown eyes or brown hair, brown eyes, you know. beautiful white skins, beautiful faces.
Yes.
And I looked at it and I looked how the people, like the people near me were looking at it. And I've seen many young girls who actually said, I actually like mixed race kids. I actually like mixed race boys, mixed race girls. I think they're beautiful. I want to be with one. Or I want to be with a black man because we all know the reason. And so I told myself, I do not want other people to risk losing years and years and years and of their genetics.
Yes.
Because of one mistake.
Yes.
Because there's never going back. There's never reverting back to white.
It's true.
Once you have black genes in you, you're going to have black genes. And you start researching into it. Mixed race kids actually have a lot of not only psychological problems, but also physical problems.
Yes. Yes.
And that is clearly a sign that something is wrong.
A weird example of this in the San Francisco Bay Area where I'm from, because there are so many white men who marry Asian women, specifically in the San Francisco Bay Area. At Stanford University Medical Center, which is where some of my brothers and sisters were born, if I remember correctly, they have done a study to inform the physicians on some of the specific problems that arise when an Asian woman is giving birth to the baby that was put in her by a white man. And basically, in a nutshell, it's just the insides of an Asian woman, the inside shape of her, is smaller than the inside shape of a white woman. So the reverse isn't a problem for the deliveries. Like if the husband is Asian and his wife is white, this isn't an issue. But that's not what happens in the Bay Area where I'm from. It's almost 100% of the time the man is white and the woman is Asian. And I think I know the reason, by the way. It's because Asian women, although they're still becoming crazy social justice warriors and going left, still the Asians are actually more traditional now than the white people in those areas. That's why. Because the men are just like, she's nice to me and she cooks. Guess what? I'm good. And so, but physiologically, there are a number of medical risks in childbirth. I actually just recently read the Stanford University medical study about it. And they have specific things they let the doctors know. If the couple is white man, Asian woman, here's some things you have to. And it's just, it's really obvious. People that breed animals know this. That kind of irresponsible breeding, it creates problems, even with farm animals. And to think that we can be reckless with our genes, with procreation, it's hateful to our children and it's vicious towards our ancestors. Yeah, it's really sad.
It is.
Yes, indeed. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your time this afternoon to talk about these very important matters.
Thank you, really.
You're welcome. It's just such a pleasure. And I wish you very, very well with this work, which I believe is a God-blessed work of white Christian dating. It's just such a blessing to know that you and your friend are doing this for our people. May God richly bless that work of yours. And I look forward to talking again very soon, God willing.
Okay. God bless you.
Okay. Same to you, sweetie. Have a good afternoon and evening.
And you too.
Next time.
Yes. Bye.
Bye for now.